News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I had the great pleasure earlier today of spending some time out at the Fresno VA Medical Center, the dedication of the Wall of Honor, the new batch of names going up on that Wall of Honor. If you ever visit the facility, I hope you'll take some time to walk through there and just look at a little bit of that price of freedom that is always visible at the VA. One man who knows that facility very well is going to be our guest today, because for decades now, he has been serving as a chaplain at the VA in Fresno. Back in World War II, he served in the 94th Infantry Division, part of a field artillery battalion. He's going to tell us those stories today. He's got a lot of stories to tell us, so we're going to get started with Richard Christensen, 87 years old, of Fresno, California, but originally from Racine, Wisconsin. And I'm guessing that's where you were on a cold Sunday, December morning, December 7th, 1941. What can you tell me about that day in Racine?
Well, in Racine, it wasn't morning when we first heard. It was about 4 in the afternoon.
Big time and difference from Honolulu to Racine.
I had stayed home from church where they were having a Christmas program. And all of a sudden, the radio became the center of attention. And, of course, the next day we went to school. And right away, I was a senior in high school at the time, and on that very day, maybe more than a dozen fellas went down and enlisted in the Marines, the Navy, and the Army. I stayed on to get my diploma and then didn't go into the Army until later that year. But it was a shocking thing on that morning or that afternoon in Racine to hear the disaster that had fallen on us there. The next day, all of the seniors in the high school were taken to the music room, and we listened to the address of Franklin D. Roosevelt when he made that famous statement about the day of infamy.
So you still remember that clear as a
bell? Yeah, very, very clear.
Now, and you grew up in a home where your father had served in World War I. In fact, you showed me a picture that I'll put up on our website, kmjnow.com, and in the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. He was one of, was it seven brothers who served in World War I?
Yes, one brother served in the Spanish-American War in 1899, that era. And then the other six out of the nine brothers served during World War I. I don't know if any of them were involved in going over to France, but I know that all of them were in the service. One other brother was a conscientious objector, so he was under that kind of regime during his time.
But you probably had a pretty good idea with your family background that you were going to end up in the service yourself, one way or the other.
Oh yeah, as soon as you turned 18, you had to register, and I did that. I was restless. I didn't like the factory job that I had. So I went down and tried first the Navy, and they wouldn't take me because of my eyesight. Then I went over to the Coast Guard office, and there was no one there. They were out to lunch. Uh-huh. And I went to the Army across the street in Milwaukee, and they said, come on in and undress. There you are. 20 minutes later, I'm in the U.S. Army.
So the Army got you by default. They were the ones that were open.
Yes.
Did you have an idea of what it would be like and what you were hoping to do in the Army? I guess you weren't hoping to do anything because you were hoping to be in the Navy. But once you were in the Army, what were your expectations and how different did they turn out to be from what actually happened?
Well, for one thing, you didn't have a great deal of choice, but I had known a fellow that was in the Coast Artillery with the Coast Guards. Mm-hmm. And I thought it might be an interesting thing. So when I went to the Army, I just put down artillery. And that's where I wound up, in a 105 artillery battery. I didn't know what to expect, to be perfectly honest. It was all new.
And that 105 millimeter howitzer is pretty big.
Yeah, it's about 4.5 inches or something like that. Every division in those days had three battalions of 105s and one battalion of 155s, which was a longer range and larger projectile. We were in the 105 outfit, and I started out as a gunner, but then they put me in what we used to jokingly call the intelligence section. We did plotting on maps and that sort of thing, and it was all in preparation for being in the forward observer business when we got overseas.
Am I making a leap to say that that maybe saved your hearing a little bit?
Oh, no. I still have hearing problems. I have had all my life.
Because of those guns?
Both because of the guns in the beginning, but in later years it was because of the other guns landing near us.
Sure.
The projectiles. They could be pretty loud, too.
And we're going to hear about how he was wounded. We'll tell you what he did with his Purple Heart and how he came upon his life's vocation as well. We've got lots to talk about with Richard Christensen, 87 years old. He lives in Fresno, California now. You heard him talk about enlisting in the Army from Racine, Wisconsin, ending up with the 356th Field Artillery Battalion, part of the 94th Infantry Division.
In later years, it was because of the other guns landing near us.
Sure.
The projectiles. They could be pretty loud, too.
And we're going to hear about how he was wounded. We'll tell you what he did with his Purple Heart and how he came upon his life's vocation as well. We've got lots to talk about with Richard Christensen, 87 years old. He lives in Fresno, California now. You heard him talk about enlisting in the Army from Racine, Wisconsin, ending up with the 356th Field Artillery Battalion, part of the 94th Infantry Division, which was on the outskirts of the Battle of the Bulge in the winter of 1944. But I'm curious when you actually got over to Europe, probably a couple months before that.
Yeah, we arrived in England in August, and then we went over to the continent, to France. And when Patton broke through at the Falaise Gap, he just bypassed two submarine bases at Saint-Nazaire and Lorient. And we were assigned first to just surround those two cities and keep them out of the war. And then on Christmas Eve, or maybe it was a couple of days before, just as the bulge began, the 66th Division was crossing a channel, and one of their large transports was sunk, and the division was depleted by quite a bit. And so they quickly put the 66th in our position and sent us up to the bulge. We didn't actually fight in the bulge itself. We were on a containment sort of assignment on the south flank. As Patton came from the south,
right,
to Bastogne, and we got there just for a short time, and then the first part of January we were moved again.
Well, and I want to talk to you about how bitterly cold it was there, but before that, why don't you give us your first taste of combat, because I'm sure you'd had a lot of anticipation to this point. Here you are, just having turned 20 years old, and you're in a war. How did you deal with that, and what was your welcome to the war moment?
One funny experience, while we were still at Lorient and Saint-Nazaire, we did have patrols go out, and there would be occasional bursts of artillery fire from the Germans. We had an officer by the name of Luke Martin. And one day we were kind of in the line of fire, and we all dove for a foxhole that we had, a rather big thing. And I crashed in on top of him. And I said, "Sorry, sir." Didn't salute. And he said, "Don't bother." He said, "Get all over me." But I guess the first really serious experience I had was in a place called Monkey Wrench Woods in Germany. We went into the woods about 6 o'clock on Sunday morning after a really heavy snowfall the night before, and it looked so pretty and nice, and we're strolling along from one tree to another, and all of a sudden machine guns and rockets and artillery begin to burst around us, and the officer that I was with, a fellow by the name of O. Henry, was killed in that very barrage. And then the other corporal and I were reassigned to another. But that morning was probably, to have come through it was really a great and wonderful thing. There was a great loss of life in that particular barrage. Monkey Wrench Woods was just as it sounds. It looked like a wrench if you looked at it from the air. And there was a little valley between the two points. Mm-hmm. And we had gone, the division had gone back and forth with the Germans over a period of about 4 days. And they would claim it, and then we get it back. And it was a difficult place.
This is probably a tough question to answer, but what were you thinking and experiencing as this was going on? Can you put us inside your brain and your emotions, what it was like to be in that place at that time, not knowing, as you said, if you would wake up the next morning or not?
Yeah. I was scared. I was a little bit shocked at the intensity of it. Was the first time I'd really come under any real fire. I think it was just out-and-out shock. I think for some minutes I didn't really. Lieutenant Henry had suffered such a wound that you could see that he had gone right away. There was nothing doubtful about it. And the other fellow and I had been behind a tree just maybe 10 feet from him. That fellow, Forden was his name, had a streak of burned cloth on the back of his coat where a piece of shrapnel had come that close to him and burned it as he went by. The whole scene, the yelling and crying and yelling for medics and so on. You said your grandfather was a surgeon. He would probably have been very, very busy after that kind of experience.
Yeah. I'm sure he was, and I've heard some stories similar to that.
Yeah.
So, but you didn't get to come home after that battle. You had to go on to another and another and another and not knowing when it's going to end. So did that change the way you approached situations in the future?
No, I think when we went in, I think this is one thing that was characteristic of World War II vets almost more than any others. We knew that there would be an end, but it would take some hard work. And we could see that we were winning the battle, but every day was a battle. The area where we were was called the Siegfried Switch. It was where one part of the Siegfried Line intercepted another section between the, it was called the Moselle-Saar Triangle because the two rivers came together. And I think the feeling of all of us was that let's get it over with as soon as we can and go home. That's pretty much still the attitude of a lot of World War II veterans, I think.
Can you describe for us what, and I realize every day was different, but in terms of your duties on a day-to-day basis with the 356th Field Artillery Battalion, what kinds of things were you doing?
Well, those of us who were forward observers, the usual forward observer set was an officer.
Right.
And then one or two non-commissioned officers, and then a driver. And the typical thing would be we would hear the day before that we were going to be involved in a action the next day. And so we would typically get together and then we'd drive off. Most of those attacks began either during the night or early in the morning. So we'd go out and find a place to rest a little bit. And then the driver would drop us off and one of us would carry the radio. I did that quite a bit, and then operate it when there was need. And then you'd join the infantry company and get your orders as to what they were going to do and what their objectives were. The officers always carried maps, and you know enough about the artillery to know that they have checkpoints, and you call back to the batteries by referring to a checkpoint and then giving them directions as how to aim at the target and bracket it, as we say. And then usually after third round, you should be on the target.
Did having a job, a duty like that, make you feel the weight of responsibility, knowing that the words that you passed on, the function that you guys performed, would have an impact on where artillery was headed and who was on the receiving end of it?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. We knew that our particular job with the infantry was to get them help.
Mm-hmm.
I never got into the situation where I had to fire person to person, but a lot of our observers would get caught out on a limb somewhere and have to fight their way out mm-hmm. by shooting. But most of the observers, for one thing, it traveled with the leader of the lot. The last day when I was in the line, we were with a Major Myers, and he was not in charge of the operation to begin with, but as the day wore on, he became the officer in charge of the whole operation. And, you know, when you're walking with him, you know that you're in a critical area.
I would think so. Absolutely. Well, we need to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to hear more of Richard Christensen's stories from World War II. We're going to hear why one NFL team wouldn't have its offensive coordinator if our guest today didn't survive World War II. Figure that one out if you can during the commercial break, and much more to come. We'll find out why he is still down at the VA in Fresno 2 days a week like he has been for decades. It's Hometown Heroes today. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to continue now with Richard Christensen, 87 years old, an Army veteran of World War II, a recipient of the Purple Heart Medal. And maybe you recognize his voice. Maybe if I said the Reverend Richard Christensen, that would ring a bell for you. He may have been your pastor at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Fresno many years ago. Maybe you see him at St. Columba's. You'll see him there this Sunday. Maybe you see him down at the VA hospital. Or if you are Ralph Wood, who's going to be on the sideline for us tonight in the Bulldog game, the Dogs host Louisiana Tech at 7:30, then you remember our guest today as the man who baptized you. Our sideline reporter and your 10 o'clock anchor on Fox 26, Ralph Wood, was the first baby that our guest today, Richard Christensen, ever baptized. We might get to that story. I know the story of how he got into the ministry goes all the way back to World War II. But let's continue now with your adventures with the 356th Field Artillery Battalion, a forward observer, part of the 94th Infantry Division of Patton's 3rd Army in Europe during World War II. You mentioned that first real taste of it you got at Monkey Wrench Woods.
Yeah,
I alluded to the Battle of the Bulge earlier, and you said you weren't right in the thick of all the action there, but I'm sure you still were in the thick of the most bitterly cold winter that Europe had experienced in decades. And you grew up in Wisconsin, and Racine can get pretty cold in the winter. Mm-hmm. But how cold was it there at the Bulge?
Well, it was so cold that one group of infantrymen from our outfit, the 301st, got caught and trapped in an orchard for 10 days. And almost every one of those fellas had trench foot or frozen feet.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably during part of that time the temperatures went down to zero, and we had lots of snow. We had, I think, probably 2-3 feet of snow in the month of January, and it was cold.
What'd you do to stay warm?
Pound your feet on the ground and clap your hands and hope that it would go away. We always were required to carry a pair of socks inside our coat. And that was part of Patton's discipline, that you should change your socks, even in cold weather. And that was really good advice, because if your feet began to perspire a bit and then get cold, that's where trench foot and frozen feet came. It was real.
And Patton wanted those guys on the lines, not in the infirmary. Absolutely. Now, along the way, in all your experiences in World War II, you mentioned close calls, like people being killed 10 feet from you. How often did you wonder, is this it for me? Is this going to be my day? Am I going to make it through this battle?
I think every time you went into a real battle, even when you weren't in battles, for instance, moving around in an area with a jeep at 10 o'clock at night with nothing but moonlight to guide you on a slippery road, knowing that there are mines all over the place, that, you know, you're aware of that all the way through. I think in the battles itself, when you actually see and hear the explosions and gunfire and so on, then you're so anxious to do what you have to do in the right way that I think there's something about that you overcome the fear, except when you stop and then you think about what's going on. But when you're running or you're lying in a foxhole or communicating on the radio, you can't let that interrupt what you're doing. There has to be a certain amount of discipline.
And I know in your case, it required a certain amount of faith. And you shared with me, you were encouraged at one point because of just a simple note that had been sent from back home that reached you out there on the lines.
Yeah, I told you that it was common to get a letter from someone in your church or some other Christian person. And one of the frequent verses of scripture that was quoted was from Psalm 91, where it says, "He shall give his angels charge over you." I received such a letter from a very good and godly lady in our church the same day that I heard that my cousin and one of my close friends had been killed in action. My cousin at St. Lo and the other friend, John Friesma, he always loved cars. He was a farmer, but he loved cars and tractors and everything. And he was a tank person when he was over there. And he was killed just about the time that I was facing my own problems. So at that point, you read that scripture and you realize that there's a reality for yourself, but there's also the fact that some people are going to die. Mm-hmm. And the Lord knows the path for each of us. And I think you learn in moments like that we don't know everything. Mm-hmm. So many, many things are in the counsels of God and nowhere else.
It sounds like maybe you're 20 years old, so I'm not going to put words in your mouth and tell you were ready to go at that point, but it sounds like it gave you some peace that you weren't in control, but somebody was.
Yeah, I think that's true. You pray every day. You pray when you're going through the ordeal, but you have to find a way of dealing with reality and knowing that even as you pray, you may die. Mm-hmm. I had that experience when myself and a man named Lieutenant Posner, 22-year-old graduate of the University of Kansas, he had come in as a replacement, and I was with him on, I think, the second battle that he entered. And he and I went up in the second story of a house. An artillery shell from German hit in a tree outside the house there. And just one shard of shrapnel went straight through his heart, and he was gone. And you realize in a moment like that every moment of the day when you're in combat could be your last. And you hope and pray that you'll make it through to the next day, but the reality is you may not.
And you would end up coming a lot closer than you wanted to. Tell me about the time that you were wounded. Where were you, and how did that unfold?
Well, it was the same day that Lieutenant Posner was killed. After he died, I helped carry him down the stairs to the first floor, and it was obvious he died immediately. Then we got a call on the radio to meet another officer at a little bridge that was already broken down and an old mill. And when we got there, we joined Captain John Wilson and Major Myers. Major Myers was in charge of the operation. The other fellow and I, Stan Forden, and I joined with that group. There were about six of us, and we aren't the frontline troops at that point. We're kind of behind, and he's directing.
Right.
He's telling people what to do.
But still a target
of
the enemy.
Yeah, I had the radio at the time, and I got a call from one of the other observers, and they said, you fellas are out in the open, and you're in range of both machine gun fire and artillery. And as he said that, Captain Wilson said to the major, let's get out of here, in rather colorful language. And Major said, just a minute more. And then we had some shells fall in front of us and some in back of us. And then you know that the next one, and an infantryman and myself and John Wilson were all hit at the same time. John Wilson was a veterinarian. Later that evening in the aid station, he sat on his helmet and was describing to the medic what nerves he thought had been. He was a brilliant man and as brave as any man I've ever seen, describing to the medic what he thought was wrong. And I profited by the fact that I was with him, in that there were a lot of people in the triage room when we got to the hospital. The captain of my outfit called the surgeon and asked him when he finished. The artillery had its own surgeon that took care of fellas. And he asked the doctor if when he finished with Captain Wilson, would he see what was going on with myself. And so I got taken care of about 1 o'clock in the morning.
But it would have been longer had he not made that
request. Yeah, I
think
so. I was in a triage room with about probably 12, 13 people. I was the only one that was conscious. I don't know if the others were asleep or unconscious, but they were much more severely wounded than I was. Then they came and got me, and the fellow asked me if I was tired, which was
1 a.m. No.
Yeah, no. He said, can you count backwards? And I said, yeah. 199, and I'm gone. And the next morning, I woke up in a hospital in Trier, looking out over the Moselle River and praising God that I had come through.
I bet. Well, what? Where were you hit? And
I was hit up in the left arm, and it took out the tricep.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, by the measure of some wounds, it wasn't really a great wound. But along the way, I got sent back to Paris, and then from there back to England. And I think all of that came because of infection, and it took quite a while to. They did some more surgery when I got back to England. So
you were in the hospital. This was March of 1945, March 13th, when you were wounded. And when did you get out of the hospital?
Got out of the hospital about the middle of June. I think it was 10th, 12th, something like that.
And for people that know their World War II history in the European theater, they know that that means you were in the hospital on May 8th of 1945.
I was. Mm-hmm.
What was that like to be in the hospital and hear, this is over, the Allies have won?
Actually, it was a wonderful experience. First of all, I was in a hospital on Easter that year also.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I can't remember if it was Okinawa or Iwo Jima, was invaded on Easter morning.
Yes, that was Okinawa.
And then of course, when Roosevelt died. And then a few days later, the Germans capitulated, and that really was, that was a wonderful feeling. I was at that time able to get around pretty good, and I had met some English people, and it was really wonderful. The first Whitsuntide holiday was right after that. Whitsuntide is, as church people know, Pentecost.
Mm-hmm.
And the English people had not had any days off, any kind of celebrated days, since 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was away on that weekend. And that was really quite an experience to see how happy they were, how much they enjoyed a new kind of freedom. One of the interesting things about my getting out of the hospital, they gave me food stamps for the 10 days leave that I had. And I went to visit a relative of one of my uncles who was from England, and I went to see his sister. And I gave her all those stamps for food.
Mm-hmm.
And she came home the next day and put everything on one plate. She said, that's 10 days worth of stamps.
Wow.
And the English had been going through that since 1939. They were a brave and good people.
And that puts it in perspective, especially, you know, in our country right now, people are facing hard times.
Yeah.
But you hear a story like that, and that puts it in perspective. So you finally get out of the hospital in June of 1945. The war's over, but you don't get to come home. And I guess looking back, maybe you're thankful for that, because it was an experience, as you are part of occupying forces in Czechoslovakia, that eventually led to your life's calling. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was charged for quarters, which means I'm on duty on Labor Day 1945. And during the mid-afternoon, about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, I heard some children crying outside the house where I was. And they kept saying, Mama, Mama, Mama. And they came toward the house, and then they still kept yelling as they went away, and it got to me. So I went outside to see what was happening. And there was an old man and two little children, probably 6 and 8 in that range, running after a young woman. The story that I got later was that she had tried several times to end her life. Her husband had been in the German army and was on the Eastern Front in Russia. And she hadn't heard from him for over 2 years and assumed probably he won't come back. And she was despondent. When we took her back to the house, she and her parents and two children lived in a room about maybe 12 by 20. They had 3 beds in there and a little kitchenette sort of thing.
And to get her back to the house, you had to tackle her.
Yeah, that's the only tackle I ever made.
Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
The medic in our group, I called him and he came over with me. I thought maybe he could give her some kind of sedative or something. And we, with kind of broken German, tried to talk to these people. And I knew enough. I had taken 2 years of German in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do very well, but I knew that the word for prayer was bitte.
Uh-huh.
I think that's right. With all the Germans in this area, I may not.
They'll let you know if you're wrong.
Yeah. But the medic and I prayed with them. And then I was moved deeply, and I went back to the office where I was, and I got down by a wooden chair there and prayed and thanked the Lord for what he had done for us. And then I committed my life to whatever kind of ministry he cared to give me. And that was on Monday, Labor Day. On Thursday of that week, battery clerk came to me and said, pack your bags, you're leaving in the morning. Oh, good, I'm going home. No, he said, you're going to England. I was sent to Shrivenham American University. And when I got there, I tried to find some way to get my orders changed so I could go home. But they said, no way. So I was there until December full semester, and I took two courses there. And when I went to the University of California, I got two A's credit for that.
So okay, it worked out.
And during that time, the chaplain asked me if I would speak at a couple of different churches. And I wound up speaking, I think, seven or eight times. And it was, for me, it was a confirmation of what had happened on Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, you know, sometimes we wonder if we're in the right place. I've never wondered if I belonged in the ministry. I've often wondered if I've done it right and whether or not the people I serve think I've done it right. But I know in my own heart that that's where God wanted me and still keeps me active.
Well, and I think that's what people are going to be impressed by. And that is a profession, a calling that you can never really retire from if you're doing it right. And that's the case for our guest today, Richard Christensen. We'll tell you how he's still serving, still ministering to people right here in the San Joaquin Valley. And I'll tell you who has his purple heart. That'll answer another question I posed earlier in the program. We'll be back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As always, the time goes by way too fast. Having a wonderful time with Richard Christensen today. He's 87 years old, a native of Racine, Wisconsin, but for the last 30 years or so, he's been here in Fresno, actually almost 40 years now, I guess. He's a longtime pastor at Westminster Presbyterian Church, and he continues to volunteer as a chaplain at the VA Medical Center 2 days a week. And maybe you've been one of those veterans who's gotten treatment there, and you've been visited by him. It must have been a good visit because you're still here, if that's the case. You heard me reference earlier his Purple Heart for the wounds that he suffered in March of 1945. You also heard me say that an NFL team wouldn't have an offensive coordinator if our guest today hadn't survived the war. That's because your son, you have two children who would have never been born if you didn't make it home from the war, five grandchildren as well. But your son, Clyde, is the offensive coordinator for the Indianapolis Colts. And you gave him your Purple Heart?
I gave it to him at Christmas a year ago. I had, when I left for the Army, my parents gave me a really nice Bible. I had used it quite a bit. It was too big to carry when you were in a combat situation, but I used it a lot otherwise. And I was especially attracted to the epistles of Paul, so that mm-hmm. by the time the war was over, those pages were worn out. but I did... I wanted the Purple Heart and that Bible to go to someone who would treasure it. And my son is a devout and good Christian man. And I felt like it was something that he would remember me by. And he has it now.
And the way the Colts season is going right now.
He needs all the prayer he can get.
He probably feels like you did out in Europe during World War II.
Yeah.
And we look forward to good days to come for Clyde Christensen and the Indianapolis Colts.
He's had a nice experience there, and his association with Tony Dungy has been really a blessing. He and Tony, with another man whose name I forget, started an organization called All Pro Dad.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
And the primary emphasis of that is to help especially athletes who all of a sudden have a lot of money and a lot of ego, and to help them realize what it means to be a good father. And Tony Dungy is an excellent mentor. He has a new book out called Mentoring,
mm-hmm.
and he really is a fine, good man. And I'm proud to say that my son has been working with him and doing well.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, your son wouldn't be here if you didn't make it home. And well, people say that's a cliche, but it's true. And yes. Obviously, he had a pretty good example, and you must have been a pretty good father to him. We heard about your inspiration and that moment at the end of World War II that led to your calling into the ministry. And certainly, that makes sense for a man at that age, and you would end up going to seminary in Seattle, meeting your wife June there. You've been married 62 years now. But I think what people will be struck by about your story, here you are 87 years old, you're walking with a cane, but you are at the VA Medical Center 2 days a week serving as a chaplain. Why are you still doing that?
Well, that's a greater blessing to me than it is to the people I talk to. I started that first while I was at Westminster. The chaplain at the time was a man named Don Welch. And one day when I was down there visiting a member of my church, he said, could you help me out a little bit? And Don Welch had classes, grief classes and substance abuse classes and so on. And he asked if I could help him with some of those. So I did that. And then when I retired, I involved myself a little bit more. And then when I did a lot of interim work, I would be away from the hospital sometimes months at a time. But I kept up my association with the CEO at the time was Joe Mason. Mm-hmm. And he was a good man. The present CEO, Al Perry, I think he runs the best hospital in town. And he has real good leadership. And it's a wonderful place to work. And I told a man yesterday morning, you've been as much help to me as I am to you. And that's really true, because when you're 87, there aren't any churches really screaming for your help.
Maybe they should be. Give us a taste, and obviously people have different issues, and that's between you and them and God, but what's it like when you go to a veteran's bedside, or you just show up and visit them in the waiting room or wherever you meet up with them? What's the idea behind it? What are you trying to do, and what are those moments that make you feel like you're getting a bigger blessing than you're delivering?
First of all, being in a secular hospital is a little different than being in a church. So
sure.
You're a little more careful how you approach things, and that's right and proper. There are a lot of different views religiously and otherwise. But I usually stop by a bedside and tell the person whom I am talking to why I'm there. There's actually, I believe this is true, I think there's a rule that every veteran should be seen by a chaplain if he's there 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The chief of chaplains now is former Lutheran pastor Terry Romerin, and I keep telling him he's made for that job. He has skills that are so useful and helpful. For instance, he's very musical.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good administrator, and there are three others like myself who are part-time chaplains, and I find it very encouraging to stop and talk with someone. Sometimes the doctors will ask you to see a particular patient. Some months ago, one of the doctors said to me, that man over there is going to have about an 8-hour surgery. Will you go and pray with him? That's exciting for me to know that, you know, sometimes we accuse the medical profession of not really being as compassionate as they are, but there are wonderful men of God in medicine, and even those who do not have an active church life themselves recognize, I think, the value of spiritual counsel and encouragement.
Every time that you walk into that building, the Fresno VA Medical Center, you walk right underneath a sign that says, the price of freedom is visible here.
Yeah.
I'm sure you had an opinion of what the price of freedom was when you were overseas in World War II.
Yeah.
But in all the years of going to that hospital, walking underneath that sign and visiting with the patients inside, what has that phrase come to mean for you?
I don't know that I can really express how deeply I feel that. You know, sometimes we take our freedoms for granted. I don't want to be political, but I sometimes have a hard time with people who protest in our country. There are lots of problems, and there are reasons to be concerned, and there are reasons to protest some things. But we have, in our United States of America, the best country in the world, even when it's failing in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that if we can encourage the veterans to just dig in and bear what they have to bear and then give as they can to the society around them. It's wonderful to see down at that hospital how many people who have real problems are kind of giving back the best they know how.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I use a walker some of the times because it's hard to walk a long distance. And in the Veterans Hospital is one place where you don't have to feel self conscious about using a cane or a crutch or a walker. There are lots of people there who have problems, but there's also very often a spirit of hope and expectation and sometimes real joy. I talked to a man just the other day who had a broken ankle and a broken elbow, and he was as bright as you would expect anybody to be who was whole. His problems were not from the war specifically, but he's an older man who really had real suffering right now. But there he is, a smile on his face, a word of cheer. Why not go down there and help a little bit? There are lots of things for people to do down there.
And maybe someone's hearing this today and is thinking that they might go down there and volunteer and help the cause as well. Yeah. And if that's how you're feeling, I hope that you'll follow through on it. In closing, when you think back on the days where you were in the service, and I'm sure it gives you more credibility with those patients down there when they know that you were in the war yourself, but when you think about your five grandchildren, your great-grandchild that's going to be born soon, what do you want those future generations of your family and Americans in general to know and understand about World War II and the men like you who made sure that America stayed America and stayed free?
Obviously, I'm a pastor, so the primary thing that I think of is giving your life to God. And along with that, I think every person who ever lived ought to really read the Bible as the Word of God. I'm reading a book by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, not by him, a biography of him. One of the things that comes through in page after page in that book is Dietrich Bonhoeffer's anchor in the scriptures. He talks about reading it as though you're talking with God. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the most fundamental thing that we could give to the American people, to get them to return to a understanding of God's sovereignty. I'm always troubled when somebody says Mother Nature is treating us bad today. It's not Mother Nature, it's God. And sometimes we don't understand the ways of God. But if we commit our lives to Him, good things will happen, even when there's stress and difficulty.
Well, it sure seems like you are living proof of that, my friend. And thank you very much for telling us about your time in World War II, all your years since. I'm sure we could fill another program with some of your stories. But thank you for your service to our country and for your continued service to veterans down there at the VA.
Well, thank you for what you're doing. And it is good to have the opportunity to share. There are lots of veterans who really lived good lives after horrible experiences. And that's true of the new veterans.
Amen.
As well as the older men like myself. God has a way of helping us to face reality and to face it with hope. And our hope is in Jesus.
Well, maybe a few people out there today found a little more hope. And I'll say hello to Ralph Wood for you tonight at the football game, that first baby he ever baptized. It's been a wonderful hour today with Richard Christensen. I hope you'll visit us again next week. Hometown Heroes will be right back with you next Saturday at 1 o'clock, the day after Veterans Day. Thank all the veterans in your life for their service to our country. We'll be back next week with more of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.